The time is now ripe for all Americans to join together in a bipartisan effort to fulfill our constitutional obligation of restoring the United States Supreme Court to full strength.
No, Ronnie. Ronnie Reagan. I don't know why I came here tonight. So quaint.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove, out in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, out in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui, up in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota, and of course, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, The Detour in East Tennessee. Welcome aboard, Detour. And, of course, Radio Sputnik, 5 days a week. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling, action-packed adventure. The entire current legal strategy of the conservative legal movement has been stymied, I might say upended, by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, according to Tierney Sneed over at TPM today. Scalia's unexpected passing robs conservatives of the 5-4 advantage they had on the Supreme Court at the very moment they were making arguably their most aggressive play yet to cement some of their most cherished and longest sought legal gains in areas like abortion, voting rights, and affirmative action. Even any favorable outcomes in some of the test cases that they have lined up for the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court has already heard are now in jeopardy, notes Tierney Sneed. We will talk about that momentarily with my guest, Ian Millhiser, after this, the past few tumultuous days, rather extraordinary days following the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. More on that in a moment. As a matter of fact, more on that throughout the show, including with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report in a little bit. Hi, Desi.
Hello.
Our producer, Desi, and of course, my co-host on the Green News Report, will be talking about the effect of Scalia's death on this unprecedented ruling, frankly, by the Supreme Court just days ago. One of Scalia's very last actions
yes,
on the court.
Yes, putting a stay on President Obama's landmark emissions reductions policy to cut emissions from power plants, called the Clean Power Plan. It was a 5-4 ruling, and mm-hmm. the conservative majority on the Supreme Court decided to put a stay on those regulations, and that would essentially freeze them while they're being adjudicated. That has never been done before.
Well, it's not unusual for the this particular court to block this particular president, but the fact that they did it while this case is still being heard in the lower court is what makes it extraordinary.
Yes.
And unprecedented. And of course, just days later, they wouldn't have been able to do it because it would have been tied 4-4, and the lower court ruling would have stood. And the lower court ruling for now says, no, the Obama's Clean Power Plan can continue throughout the challenge that is being brought against it.
Right. And that would be the norm. That is the norm with every other federal regulation that has ever been promulgated ever in the history of the United States.
You just said promulgated.
Yes.
So right there, I'm impressed with you, Desi Doyen. We'll come back to you more in a bit on that story and much more in our Green News Report a little bit later today. Also, Ben Carson Ben Carson, who I have long said is yes, he's a neurosurgeon. Yes, for some reason, people call him brilliant. I don't find him to be so brilliant. As a matter of fact, I don't find him to be really smart in the least. You know, nothing personal, but I'm just not impressed by him. He gets a lot wrong. And in fact, during the GOP debate over the weekend in South Carolina, Ben Carson actually said that there was nothing in the Constitution. What did he say? There was nothing in the Constitution about the president's powers to nominate, to appoint, and nominate.
That is exactly what he said. Yeah. Well, the Constitution doesn't say anything about this particular situation.
So no genius he. However, even a stop clock is right twice a day. Ben Carson conceded in a recent interview that he did not think the GOP would stall a potential Supreme Court nominee if their own party controlled the White House. Oh, you think? In an appearance on South Carolina radio station WRNN, Carson was asked if the presidential candidates on the debate stage last Saturday would have the same position if a Republican controlled the executive branch. He admitted, quote, "No, they wouldn't."
Well, at least he's intellectually honest.
At least on that point.
On that one small thing.
And at least for that one moment, because just moments later he said, "Recognize that the two picks that the president has selected so far," he's talking about Sotomayor and Kagan, "that they are ideologues. So there's really no reason to believe that his next pick wouldn't be an ideologue also." Hardly ideologues, either of them, Sotomayor or Kagan. At least they have not revealed themselves to be ideologues. Certainly not of the type of right-wing ideologue that clearly Antonin Scalia was. But in any case, at least he was right for a moment in time. Ben Carson was there. In the meantime, as you know, we talked about it on yesterday's program, Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader for the Republicans, said that he would not even allow hearings to move forward, which is, in fact, unprecedented. The fact that there would be no hearings and this claim that, oh, it's the last year of a presidential administration, therefore there will be no confirmation to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court. That has never happened, despite what he says. And essentially, do we have that? Yeah, we do. Here's that quote from Mitch McConnell about whether he would allow this nomination to move forward.
"None shall pass."
What?
"None shall pass."
Okay, not really Mitch McConnell, but
Monty Python, but
close
you get
enough.
The idea.
Close enough. Yeah, because if you look back at what Mitch McConnell said in 2005, he said, quote, "The Constitution of the United States is at stake." This was when Democrats were potentially blocking some of George W. Bush's appointees to the court. He said, "Article 2, Section 2 clearly provides that the president and the president alone nominates judges. The Senate is empowered to give advice and consent, but my Democratic colleagues want to change the rules. They want to reinterpret the Constitution to require a supermajority for confirmation. In effect, they would take away the power to nominate the president and grant it to a minority of 41 senators." So at that point, he was talking not even about hearings. He was talking about Democrats blocking a nomination with a filibuster. He also said the Republican conference intends, this was, again, back in 2005, Mitch McConnell, "The Republican conference intends to restore the principle that regardless of party, any president's judicial nominees, after full debate, deserve an up or down vote. I know that some of our colleagues wish that restoration of this principle were not required, but it is a measured step that my friends on the other side of the aisle have unfortunately made necessary for the first time in 214 years, said Mitch McConnell in 2005. "Democrats have changed the Senate's advice and consent responsibilities to advice and obstruct." And at that point, he was talking about getting an up or down vote for nominees. He wasn't even talking about whether they would hold hearings, which he has now said, no, we will not hold hearings in the U.S. Senate. Whether that holds, however, there is a question. More on that in a moment. The president of the United States, meanwhile, was speaking just moments ago at a press conference in Rancho Mirage, California, near Palm Springs out here. And he was asked about the Supreme Court vacancy, had a lot to say, but here in general is the gist of much of his comments.
"But this is the Supreme Court, and it's going to get some attention.
And we have to ask ourselves as a society a fundamental question, are we able to still make this democracy work the way it's supposed to, the way our founders envisioned it? And I would challenge anyone who purports to be adhering to the original intent of the founders, anybody who believes in the Constitution, coming up with a plausible rationale as to why they would not even have a hearing for a nominee made in accordance with the Constitution by the President of the United States, with a year left practically in office. It's pretty hard to find that in the Constitution.
Yeah, it is. You know who the Republicans could use right now? Antonin Scalia. He was somebody who pretended to believe in the Constitution, and he would come up with all kinds of things that weren't in there at all kinds of reasons to actually do the opposite of what the Constitution said. But, can't lean on Scalia for that anymore. In the meantime, Republicans, that was the president speaking moments ago, but Republicans... on Monday, they began to close ranks behind Mitch McConnell and his vow to not consider any nominee from the president. Senator Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, he faces re-election this year. He said in a statement that the Senate should follow what he called common practice to stop acting on lifetime appointments during the last year of a presidential term. There is no such common practice, Senator. Senator Patrick J. Toomey, Republican of Pennsylvania, also agreed, leaving nearly every vulnerable Republican incumbent backing Mr. McConnell's pledge. The fact is, however, none of the last 12 successful Supreme Court nominees waited any longer than 100 days for a confirmation vote. And President Obama will not leave office for about 340 days. In the meantime, while those Republicans are coming together to block the president, there are some indications that there may be an opening here. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, Republican of Iowa, he's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's the one who would hold these hearings in the U.S. Senate if they, in fact, move forward. Over the weekend, he said he would wait until the nominee is made before making. Actually, no. Over the weekend, he agreed with Mitch McConnell on this. But now he is telling Radio Iowa, he said, I would wait until the nominee is made before I would make any decisions. He says this is a very serious position to fill, and it should be filled and debated during the campaign and filled by either Hillary Clinton, Senator Sanders, or whoever's nominated by the Republicans. So it sounds like he was, walking back his previous comments just a little bit. There may be some wiggle room there. At the same time, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, she is not up for re-election. She, too, sought a middle ground. She said, quote, our role in the Senate is to evaluate the nominee's temperament, intellect, experience, integrity, and respect for the Constitution and the rule of law, suggesting she might be open to hearings. One more crack in the foundation came from Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina. Over the weekend, he said that Obama should not nominate the next justice, but he added today, quote, I think we fall into the trap if we just say sight unseen. We fall into the trap of being obstructionists if they say no. So there is perhaps some wiggle room if they are looking for inspiration on what to do. Perhaps they could turn to King Ronnie, to Lord Reagan, to the highly exalted Ronaldus Maximus, who said this back in 1988, his final year in office, when he was calling on the Senate to do their constitutional duty and fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court with now Justice Anthony Kennedy.
I believe the mood and the time is now right for all Americans in this bicentennial year of the Constitution to join together in a bipartisan effort to fulfill our constitutional obligation of restoring the United States Supreme Court to full strength. By selecting Anthony M. Kennedy, a superbly qualified judge whose fitness for the High Court has been remarked upon by leaders of the Senate in both parties, I have sought to ensure the success of that effort.
That, of course, was Liberal Democrat Ronald Reagan back in 1988 calling on the Senate to approve his nominee, calling on the Democratic majority Senate, I should add, to approve his nomination of Anthony Kennedy to the Supreme Court, which they did in an election year unanimously. Just saying. So this fight is absolutely extraordinary. It is unprecedented. Any of these Republicans who you hear saying, oh, it's tradition, we never do this in the final year, that's absolutely nonsense. That is absolutely extraordinary for them to block for what would amount to at least a year, actually a year and a half or so by the time the new president, whoever it is, comes in and they nominate someone and that person goes through the nomination and voting process. So this is all extraordinary. But there has been a lot of extraordinary things since Antonin Scalia's death over the weekend. One of the most amazing things to me was learning from the SCOTUS blog, a blog that almost exclusively follows the U.S. Supreme Court, that when they explained just after the news had broken about the death of the controversial Supreme Court justice, that any cases this session that Scalia had already heard and had already voted on, but that have not yet been released publicly, won't count now that he has died. Writing over at SCOTUS blog, Tom Goldstein said, votes that the justice cast in cases that have not been publicly decided are void. That was quickly offered as the definitive word on this matter. That is amazing, if true, because a lot of important cases have been heard so far in this past session of the Supreme Court, but have yet to be handed down publicly. If they were decided 5-4 one way or another, or at least they were going to be decided 5-4 with Scalia included in that 5-vote majority, those cases will now be a 4-4 tie decision instead. That could be very good or very bad news for both parties. Unexpected news, to be sure, in many of these cases, many of which were brought to the court after pretty clear signals from the court's right-wing majority that they wanted to hear such cases so that they could make some fairly landmark rulings on a number of very big and very contentious issues in this country. A number of those cases we've discussed on this program over the past many months with constitutional law expert Ian Millhiser of Think Progress Justice. He is also author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. But of course, much of what we thought we knew when we had Ian last on about some of these cases may now be completely upside down. Joining us now is Ian Millhiser, whose writings have appeared in the New York Times, LA Times, U.S. News and World Report, Slate, Guardian, American Prospect, Yale Law and Policy Review, and the Duke Law Journal. Ian Millhiser, welcome back to the broadcast. Thank you for joining us so quickly after we recently spoke to you.
Good to be back. Yeah, it seems like a whole lot has happened since then.
You think? This is really big doings. And I want to go through. You wrote a great piece headlined "The Simply Breathtaking Consequences of Justice Scalia's Death," where you go through sort of case by case the big cases that are before the court that may now be decided totally differently. But before we go through those, there has now been discussion that Scalia was dealing with some very serious medical issues of late. And while you and I had also spoken on the show about the idea that some 4 Supreme Court seats may be filled by the next president, I don't think anybody suspected Scalia was going to be the first to go like this. Did they? This must have come as much of a shock to you as anybody else.
Yeah, well, I mean, Scalia was 79 years old, and, you know, when you get to be that age, you know, mm-hmm. mortality is a thing. You know, one thing to bear in mind from this is that there are 3 justices who are still on the court and are also quite elderly. So, mm-hmm. you know, we could have as many as 4 vacancies on the Supreme Court at very short order. And with the dysfunctional Senate that we have right now, that means we could potentially have four vacancies and no possibility of filling them in the foreseeable future.
And that foreseeable future could go beyond even this term. I've heard, obviously all of the Republicans now are taking this unprecedented stance that the next president should decide, right, even though there's a year left. But there's really no guarantee. I've seen this discussed as well from various legal scholars. There's really no guarantee that if a Democrat is elected in 2016 to serve beginning next year, and the Republicans still control the majority in the Senate, there's actually no real guarantee that they would consent to a presidential appointment in the next period either. I mean, we could go 3, 4, 5 years without a full complement on the Supreme Court, couldn't we?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, you are looking at, right now their talking point is that we want the next president to be the one to fill the seat. Mm-hmm. But you really think that if a year from now it's President Hillary Clinton or President Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm, that Mitch McConnell is going to say, oh, well, I didn't like Barack Obama, but I just love Hillary so much that, of course, I'm going to let her get her nominee through. I mean, chances are the country is going to be in the exact same position if Mitch McConnell is still the majority leader that we find ourselves in right now. And so it's possible that these seats could remain vacant for years. I mean, pretty much the only way that it looks likely that there's going to be nominees confirmed to these seats is if after the election there is a president and a Senate of the same party.
Is there any precedent for going this long, whether it's now a year? That would actually be more like a year and a half if it's not until the next president comes to office that someone is appointed. So a year and a half to, as many as I say, 3, 4, 5 years. Has this ever happened in the history of this country?
Yeah, I don't know of a circumstance where a seat was vacant. I mean, there are circumstances where a justice decided to retire, mm-hmm, and they said, I'll keep my seat until you find a replacement for me. And it took a little while to find that replacement. But even in those circumstances, I know of no case where the party that controls the Senate announced, in Mitch McConnell's case, like it seemed like it was within minutes of the news breaking,
yeah,
that there was a vacancy, that it doesn't matter who Barack Obama, doesn't matter who the President of the United States sends up, that person will not be confirmed.
We are obviously in uncharted territory, and I think that even some of the conventional wisdom that it has become conventional wisdom, as you say, that, no one is going to be appointed under this president, but the idea that they would be appointed under the next president, I am questioning that conventional wisdom as well. And also, I wanted to ask you, Ian Millhiser, about what SCOTUS blog wrote. They declared fairly quickly, as I noted, that votes that Scalia had cast in cases that have not been publicly decided are void. Now,
yep.
Is that a certainty? Is that more
yes,
that's more a tradition than law, correct? I mean, couldn't justice?
No, that is a certainty. I mean, the case isn't decided until it's handed down.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's handed down today, there are only 8 justices. The fact that Justice Scalia was once a justice is no more relevant than the fact that Thurgood Marshall was once a justice or that, John Marshall was once a justice 200 years ago. What matters is who sits on the Supreme Court at the moment the case is handed down. So any case that's handed down tomorrow, I mean, it might have a footnote acknowledging that Scalia was present for the oral argument, but there will be 8 justices.
Okay.
Who decide that case?
Well, so let me just confirm this with you. In other words, you're saying that Chief Justice John Roberts could not come out tomorrow and say, "Hey, these 3 or 4 cases, Scalia had already voted on, his decision, his opinion had already been written, they are completely done. The only thing that didn't happen was they weren't released to the public." You're saying there's no way that he could do that and justify that in any way, shape, or form, right?
Well, I never put anything past Chief Justice Roberts,
uh-huh,
But no, I mean, it's very well established that the rule is that the opinion is, you know, the decision is not final until the opinion is handed down. I mean, look at what happened in the first Affordable Care Act case, where Chief Justice Roberts famously flipped his vote.
Mm-hmm.
The dissenters couldn't complain, but you said you were going to repeal Obamacare before you said you were against it before you were for it. Doesn't matter. It is not a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States until the minute the Supreme Court, theoretically, the justices could be in the robing room, putting on their robes, getting ready to walk out and announce an opinion, and one of them could turn to the other seven and say, you know what? I changed my mind. I'm going to switch my vote on this case. And then they'd have to go back to their chambers and redo the opinion.
Okay. I'm going to hope you're right about that. Like I said, I don't trust Roberts. I've seen enough from this court where I think he could say, well, you know what, in the interest of continuity in this country, since this case was already done, already written, all the opinions were already on paper, we're going to go with it as is. So this is a settled matter and we don't have a split. But I hope he doesn't. I hope you're right and I'm totally off base. Speaking of being totally off base, let me make sure ask you about this. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution says, of course, that the president shall nominate and appoint Supreme Court justices with advice and consent of the Senate. Must he wait for them to vote on a nominee? Is there any workaround there? Has there ever been any difference in the way that works? Or does the majority of the U.S. Senate essentially hold all of the cards here for as long as they wish to hold them?
Yeah, I mean, as a practical matter, he needs a majority vote in the Senate to confirm a nominee. What the Republican caucus is doing now, it's unprecedented, it's unprofessional. I could come up with a lot of other words for it that I'm not allowed to say on the radio, but, like, it's something they have the power to do. You cannot be confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States unless a majority of the Senate votes for you. And that's why we potentially find ourselves in the beginning of a constitutional crisis now, because, like I said, it's not like they're going to be, it's not like Republican senators are likely to be any keener to confirm someone to the Supreme Court if it's Hillary Clinton's nominee or Bernie Sanders' nominee. And so we could be waiting a really long time. There's also the fact that, don't expect Democrats to forget what happened here. The next time there's a Republican in the White House and a Democratic Senate, I wouldn't expect anyone to be confirmed either. So we're potentially now entering a period where the only time when anyone will ever be confirmed to the Supreme Court is when the same party controls the Senate and the White House.
But we do have the president does have the ability to make a recess appointment. Correct. Now, I know in modern times they don't go on recess anymore. They consider these sessions to be continuing, even though no one is actually there. But is there any workaround there? And is there any precedent there where presidents have appointed Supreme Court justices for lifetime position without the consent during a recess appointment?
Yeah, there are plenty of precedents for people being recess appointed to the Supreme Court. Earl Warren was a recess appointment before he was confirmed. President Washington recess appointed John Rutledge to the Chief Justiceship. So, there's plenty of precedents for recess appointments to the Supreme Court. That's not really all that controversial. The problem is that the Supreme Court recently shrunk the recess power so much that, it doesn't not exist anymore, but, it may only exist once a year for about 5 seconds. literally, that's the smallness of the window where the president can use that power. And so, for now, the president's saying he's not going to make a recess appointment. I think there's good reason for him not to make a recess appointment right now, because a recess appointment is temporary. It's a maximum of 2 years if you time it at the exact right moment. Mm. You want someone permanent there. So you want someone permanent there for a lot of reasons.
And of course, if it was challenged, his ability to recess appoint someone, that would go to the Supreme Court, which is now divided 4-4 along ideological lines. And to that end, Ian Millhiser, let me take a quick break, and we'll come back and go through some of these cases, these huge cases that now may have a completely different outcome than we had been predicting over the past several months. I'm speaking with Ian Millhiser, constitutional law expert from Think Progress Justice, author of the book Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Let's take a quick break, and we will be back with more Millhiser right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, speaking with my guest, constitutional expert Ian Millhiser. He is author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, talking about what he describes as the simply breathtaking consequences of Justice Scalia's death. And of course, we've been talking about those consequences, how to replace him, if he can ever be replaced with this current broken, dysfunctional U.S. Senate that we have. But more directly, a bunch of cases have been heard over the past several months this session. Affirmative action, abortion, birth control, immigration, big issues that we thought were going to be decided one way, but now may be decided a completely different way, since the fact is, as we discussed in the last segment, anything that Justice Scalia had heard and voted on, but the case had not yet been handed down publicly, his vote is now void. That changes the very narrow 5-4 rulings we might have had in many of these cases to a 4-4 tie. What does that mean? That's what I want to go through with Ian Millhiser, case by case here. Ian, let's run through these as quickly as we can. The first one, some good news and some bad news, depending on how you look at it, on immigration, U.S. v. Texas. Where had that case been up till now, and where will it be now that Scalia's vote won't count?
Well, there's potential for considerable chaos here. So this is the challenge to the programs President Obama announced a little while ago that would allow about 5 million undocumented immigrants to temporarily remain in the country and to work while they're here. The lower court struck down those programs, and it issued a nationwide injunction, which is not something that a lower court's really supposed to do under these circumstances. The Supreme Court, Scalia with an all but certain vote against Obama here, he's gone. I'm not convinced it's going to be a 4-4. I think that Roberts and Kennedy are both in play. But if Roberts and Kennedy both vote with the conservatives, it'll be a 4-4. That means that the lower court's opinion with its nationwide injunction stands. But where things get really odd is what happens if the Justice Department or someone else goes to another court and gets a decision saying that, in fact, these programs are legal. And then you have two equal lower courts. One says it's illegal, the other says it's legal. I don't know of a precedent for what to do there, because normally what you do is you go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court would tell you the answer. That's not something that's available right now.
So normally the Supreme Court will generally only pick up a case when there already is some sort of a split among the various circuits, and they sort of come in and settle the tie. But if they settle the tie here with a tie, all of these different laws of the land in different places of the land, right?
Yeah, no, and that's what a lot of the future could look like. I mean, you know, to take another big case that's pending right now, the Zubik case deals with whether or not a woman's boss gets to decide if that woman can have birth control coverage in their health plan. And most courts have said that, no, your boss doesn't get to make that decision. One circuit, though, the Eighth Circuit, has said, yes, they do. And so if you live in the Eighth Circuit, if you're a woman who lives in the Eighth Circuit, that's Arkansas and Iowa and Nebraska and Minnesota, and I think one other state, if you live in the Eighth Circuit, that means you have less rights than women in the rest of the country. It means that you could be a woman who works in Mississippi, and you could have one set of rights. You could have a right to have that birth control coverage in your health plan. And you cross the border into Arkansas, and suddenly you lose that right.
Which, doesn't that defy something that Scalia used to pretend he cared about, the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution? Federally, if you've got one right in one state, not in another, that in itself causes a constitutional concern, does it not?
Well, and that's why we have the Supreme Court. I mean, there's the reason why the court typically takes up what are called circuit splits, where one circuit court disagrees with another, is because you don't want a situation where the Constitution means one thing in Minnesota and something completely different in Pennsylvania. You know, you don't want a situation where there's some federal law that means one thing in California, another thing in Texas. You know, the whole point of having a federal government, having a national government, is that the things that the national government, the laws that it passes, and the things that are in the federal constitution are national. They apply to everyone in the nation. And that comes into doubt now that we have a Supreme Court that's, that may be evenly divided.
In Texas, the state lawmakers there have been radically restricting the right to an abortion in that state. The very conservative Fifth Circuit upheld the Texas law there. That was headed to the Supreme Court. That was seen as, it was believed, was it not, that that was going to also be upheld at the Supreme Court 5-4 prior to this case, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt?
Yeah, so this case, it involves what are essentially sham health laws. So the general rule is that a state can't pass a law for the purpose of restricting abortion, and that's it. But they can pass laws for certain, for certain other purposes. Mm-hmm. One totally legitimate reason why a state could regulate an abortion clinic is to make sure that it's safe, to make sure that it's healthy. So, you know, if there's an abortion clinic that, you know, for example, is unsterile, the state to pass a law saying, no, you have to have sterile facilities in your abortion clinic. And, like, that's a perfectly fine law.
Right.
What Texas did here is they passed what are essentially sham health laws. They passed laws that look, if you don't know that much about health policy, they look like health laws, but really all they do is they just make it very, very hard for abortion clinics to operate, and they impose very expensive burdens on them. And they don't actually do anything to benefit anyone's health. And so the question here is whether or not states can get away with that kind of thing. I don't know for sure. Like, Kennedy's vote is thought to be in play in this case as well. It's possible that Kennedy will cross over with liberals and say, no, what Texas did here is beyond the pale. But it's by no means certain. And if you get a 4-4 decision here, that, for, you know, the Fifth Circuit's opinion upholding the Texas law won't apply everywhere, but it will apply in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at these cases we just went through, immigration, abortion, birth control, they looked like it was going to be bad news for progressives, and it looks like the death of Scalia may or may not change that equation. But even if it does, even if it reverts to the lower court ruling, as you note, Ian, it's only in those places. Yes, it causes confusion around the country, but it could have been worse had Scalia been in there and these things became precedent for the entire nation. So that might be seen as a bit of good news. And there is actually some out and out good news. I want to get to that very quickly. But just one thought from you on this, Ian. Does Justice Roberts now and all of the justices have an interest in going back and relooking at these cases to see if they can come up with a more narrow agreement so that they don't end up with a tie one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, like, the justices, I mean, there's some very ideological justices, but, like, most of them are also institutionalists. I think that Roberts in particular would rather have there be a narrow but coherent opinion emerge mm-hmm. from the Supreme Court than a 4-4 split. And so, yeah, in some of these cases that have already been argued where there was going to be a clear 5-justice majority, it's possible that they will go back and look for ways to sort of punt on the issue that will at least produce an opinion. That's certainly possible. But what Scalia's death means in a lot of these cases is, you know, where it looks like there was a possibility of a sweeping conservative change to the law, that just doesn't look like it's on the table anymore.
All right. We spoke a few weeks ago, maybe a few months ago now, time is flying, about what appeared to be almost certain very bad news for public sector unions after the oral arguments in Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association that would have disallowed the so-called agency fees that non-union workers are required to pay to unions because the unions negotiate, you know, better salaries, better right. benefits, and so forth for everyone. Looks like the Supreme Court was going to strike that down. Now, where are we, Ian, with the death of Scalia?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest winner in the past week are the public sector unions. So what agency fees are is that if you work in a unionized shop, the union's still required to negotiate on your behalf. All the benefits, all the increased salary, everything that the union gets for everything else they have to get for you as well. But you're not required to join the union. So you could potentially get something for nothing because the union gets a bigger salary for you and you don't have to pay any dues. What these agency fees are is that the agency fees are the reimbursement that individual workers have to give to the union mm-hmm. to pay their fair share of the cost of getting all these additional benefits if they are not members of the union. So no one gets something for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like the Supreme Court was going to strike down these agency fees, at least in the context of public sector unions. They just lost their fifth vote to do so. And so without that fifth vote, without Scalia, all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden, it looks like the status quo is going to be maintained.
So
that the agency fees will remain legal.
So it reverts to the lower court. The lower court had said, yes, these fees are legal.
Well, the Supreme Court said like 30 years ago in a case called Abood that they're legal. So this was a case about whether or not the Supreme Court was going to overrule a longstanding precedent. It looked like the answer was yes, but now they don't have the votes to do it.
All right, redistricting, one man, one vote had incredibly come up before this court in a case that could have changed the way basically states were allowed to create congressional districts. And the right-wingers who brought this case were hoping that this was going to sort of consolidate power with white rural voters. Where does that case, Evanwell v. Abbott, now stand?
Yeah, so this is another case where, like, the outcome could very well change. The plaintiffs here are pushing a very aggressive legal theory, and, like, the consequences of it is it would have essentially shifted power from Latino communities to white communities in a number of states when those states were allocating congressional districts. So, like, in effect, it's in cases like Texas, if you lived in a Latino community, you would have less representation. If you lived in a white community, you'd have more representation. It looked, again, like there might be 5 votes for this after the oral argument.
Mm-hmm.
Now it doesn't look that way anymore because the plaintiffs needed Scalia, and he's not there.
And the lower court, again, in this case, had ruled against the plaintiffs, and the decision, if there's a tie at the Supreme Court, that will go back to the lower court, which had ruled against this crazy, unprecedented redistricting idea that would have affected the entire nation and frankly, helped Republicans at the voting booth. We're going to speak in the in the next segment, without you, Ian, about the case concerning Obama's Clean Power Plan and what the Scalia's vote meant there. But I want to get one more before I let you go. I know you got to go on affirmative action, a very important case, challenging affirmative action, and another one of these cases that probably would not have even been brought to the court, correct? Had the plaintiffs not relied on a right-wing majority there to help them out?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, this is the case where the death of Scalia is likely to matter the least. And that's because Justice Kagan was already recused, who's an Obama appointee, was recused from the case.
Ah.
So, you know, there's some uncertainty about what Kennedy wants to do. He might punt it down to the lower court, although that seems less likely now because he may no longer have the majority to kill affirmative action. I think what's going to happen here is that if the conservatives stay together, instead of having a 4-4 decision, you're going to have a 4-3 decision, and that's enough to strike down the plan.
Ian, this is so unprecedented. This is so extraordinary. Every time we finish talking, I say I suspect I'll be speaking with you soon. Now I really mean it. I suspect we're going to be talking quite a bit over these next few months, and who knows, next few years after all of this fine mess. Ian Millhiser, check out his work, of course, at thinkprogress.org. And by his very smart book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian Millhiser, always great to talk to you, my friend. Thank you again for joining us on short notice on this one as well.
All right. Thanks, Brad.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and come back with more Bradcast, including a Green News report. And well, as I mentioned, questions about Scalia's decision on Obama's Clean Power Plan. That and much more ahead. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Melting for Desi Doyen right here on the Bradcast and the Green News Report. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you, Des. Before we get to the Green News Report, I'm what do they say in Twitter speak? I am still just SMH.
Shaking my head
over what the news events of the last few weeks. It is just amazing. And you and I talked about it. A little bit. Haven't gotten to talk about it on air that much.
Right.
We've been so busy. But we were talking about how had any other Supreme Court justice died, even on the right, it would not have had this sort of earthquake quality. Well, maybe it would have had this earthquake quality because we're talking about the balance of the court now changing.
Right. And not just the balance of the court changing, but one of the most conservative and I would say judicially radical judges ever to sit on the Supreme Court, who was willing to pull in old cases and bring them back so he could relitigate and put a conservative, radical, I should say, conservative stamp on them. So, you know, Scalia is not just any balance of power person. He is sort of like the fulcrum of what environmental law might or could be, depending on which path we take.
Environmental law, in this case, obviously all laws of the land. But we had used the, it would be for those comic book fans out there, if any superhero in the Justice League of America was killed, that would be a devastating blow to the Justice League. However, this is the equivalent of kind of losing Superman for the Republicans, isn't it? On the bench.
Yeah, we kind of equated everybody with the Justice League. So, you know, for what that's worth, if something were to happen, say, to Ginsburg or Alito, you know, they would be sort of like a Batman equivalent level of changing the tectonic forces underlying it.
But if on you get their rid respective
of,
sides.
On their respective sides. But when you get rid of Superman, man, that sort of changes everything. That's what I equate it with.
And you know what? I already feel bad comparing Scalia to Superman because I really like Superman and I really dislike Antonin Scalia.
But this is just a metaphor. So.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for making that clear. Okay. I don't know if we have any metaphors in our latest Green News report, but I know we've got a lot of news to get to in that report. So here we go. Our latest Green News report.
There should have been a giant headline that said Supreme Court attacks Earth.
The sudden passing of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia leaves U.S. climate action and the planet hanging in the balance.
Coal miners and their families who helped turn on the lights and power our factories for generations are now wondering, Has our country forgotten us?
Hillary Clinton calls for assistance for coal country.
Why does the fossil fuel industry spend huge amounts of money on campaign contributions?
Bernie Sanders keeps hammering Republicans on climate change. Plus,
but listen, if you're visiting LA and you're feeling the burn, that just may be the methane. You know,
because the worst natural gas spill in U.S. history is finally plugged.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
No, they capped it. Did you hear that? They capped. We've had a horrible methane leak here. That, yeah, they finally did it. They used a combination of mud and stabilizing fluid and cement, the same stuff Trump uses on his hair.
Oh, man, this is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it was just days ago we were talking about the unprecedented move by Antonin Scalia and the Supreme Court to shut down the president's landmark clean power plan. Well, now it's a whole new world, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It promises to be an epic battle over the nomination of a new justice for the U.S. Supreme Court after conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia passed away over the weekend, with huge long-term implications, not just for the nation, but also for the planet. In one of his last official acts, Justice Scalia voted to put a stay on President Obama's Clean Power Plan, the first ever emission standards for the nation's polluting power plants, freezing those rules in an unprecedented ruling that implied that the right-wing majority intended to eventually overturn it.
And the reason it was unprecedented is because this case is still being heard in the lower courts.
Right. And scientists warn that without the Clean Power Plan, it will be very difficult for the U.S. to meet its international emissions obligations in the historic Paris Agreement. And that has grave implications for future generations. So a shift in the balance of the deeply divided court could have very long-range consequences for the U.S. and the world. Regardless of the makeup of the future Supreme Court, and regardless of the ultimate fate of the Clean Power Plan, however, energy industry analysts say the coal industry is not coming back in the U.S., where coal as a source of electricity appears to be in terminal decline. Speaking of coal, in the most recent Democratic presidential debate, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called for assistance for coal country, highlighting her little-known proposal to assist folks in Appalachia and other coal states with funding for the transition to renewable energy and job training.
I've come forward with, for example, a plan to revitalize coal country, the coal field communities that have been so hard hit by the changing economy, by the reduction in the use of coal. And I'm going to do everything I can to address distressed communities.
And those communities need it. You've got all of these coal workers. They could easily be retrained and given different jobs, installing solar, installing wind, making the same good living and yet not killing themselves and the planet at the same time.
Now, at that same Democratic debate and also at the Republican presidential debate over the weekend, the corporate debate media moderators failed to ask a single question about climate change or energy. So Democratic presidential candidate and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders brought it up himself.
Why does the fossil fuel industry spend huge amounts of money on campaign contributions? Any connection to the fact that not one Republican candidate for president thinks and agrees with the scientific community that climate change is real and that we have got to transform our energy system?
Yeah, there might be a connection, but we'd appreciate it if you didn't say it out loud, Bernie Sanders.
Big moves for the U.S. auto industry. Both General Motors and Tesla have announced that their next generation all-electric long-range cars, which can go over 200 miles on a single charge, will come in at a game-changing price of $30,000 or less, thanks to a rapid decline in the cost of batteries. That's with state and federal tax incentives, but it brings the cost of an all-electric car in line with the average price of a conventional gasoline car.
When's that new Tesla come out?
2017.
We could use a game changer around here.
Finally, the largest natural gas spill in U.S. history has finally been stopped. Southern California Gas Company, responsible for the massive natural gas leak from an underground storage facility in Porter Ranch near Los Angeles, has announced it plugged the broken well after 4 months. It's the first step in plugging the leak for good, and it's cost the company nearly $1 billion so far.
So sad. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime from Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Just breathe. What was it, a month or two ago, Desi Doyle, when we drove out past Porter Ranch and from the highway?
You could smell
it. You could smell the stench of that horrible methane leak?
Yes, it was surprising and extensive that we were probably, I would say, at least half a mile from the storage tanks where the leak was occurring. And these people lived within 1,000 feet.
At least.
Easily.
We did not even know that we were actually going by a Porter, or didn't notice that we were in the neighborhood of Porter Ranch as we drove by on the highway and smelled that terrible stench. And it was like, oh.
That's what they're talking
about.
We must
be near Porter Ranch. Yeah. So just amazing. Glad that that is now filled up for now.
It looks so far so good. They've now begun pouring cement into it. If you remember from the BP oil spill, mm-hmm. that is the thing that if it works, it kills the well. So that is what they're planning on doing. However, they are still planning on extracting all that gas. They're not going to shut it down completely forever. Southern California Gas Company still wants that money. So they are planning on still extracting that gas in some fashion so that they can continue to sell it.
Well, you know, there's money. We can't just leave that in the ground.
God forbid.
We've got to burn it. Yeah, amazing. And on that car, by the way, the electric car, when do I get one of those? When do I get a Tesla?
The Tesla won't be available until 2017 at the earliest, but they're usually late, so probably 2018.
However,
the Chevy Bolt, that's Bolt with a B like boy, that is going to be available at the end of 2016.
Bolt, not Volt.
Correct.
And so much lower price, like the Tesla, the Tesla Model 3, much lower price.
Yes.
And you think they're going to be late, which is sad, because I was going to ask you, does that mean 2017? Does that mean it's going to come out at the end of 2016?
Well, for the
model year?
Only for the Bolt, not for the Tesla, unfortunately.
All right. Well, I was going to say thank you to our producer, Desi Doyen, but I'll say thanks for nothing, Desi Doyen. See if you can talk to your friend Elon Musk and do something about that. Anyway, yes, thank you, Desi. Also, my thanks to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and to my guest today, Ian Millhiser of Think Progress Justice. What an amazing turn of events. Thanks to you, of course, for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, download it at bradblog.com or over at iTunes. And please give us a nice review over there and help spread the word. You can drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can find and follow me on the Twitters and the Facebooks at TheBradBlog. That's it. I'm out of here for now. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.